Call the meeting in order. This morning, members, we have the Department of Revenue again with us. Commissioner Salamone to go through, or at least to start going through, the governor's proposal as far as the impacts on state and local revenues. Welcome back, Commissioner. We'll hope today is just as exciting as things were yesterday.
I was excited.
Mr. Chair, right. I'm not sure I'll help you out with that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Salamone. I'm Commissioner of Revenue. As the Chair noted, we're here to walk you through the details of the governor's revenue proposals for the 06-07 biennium. And I believe you have a document that contains the budget pages for each of the initiatives. Hopefully it's the same one I'm going to be walking through. Otherwise we'll
follow yours.
Okay. Well, as you know, the budget contains a number of provisions affecting revenues. Many of them are related to, well, all of them are related to the governor's priorities and job, for job growth, economic development, health care, transportation. So many of the revenue items are related to initiatives of the governor. Let me start by talking about proposal to change the renter credit, and I'm going to proceed along the lines of the items that will be in the order that they could are in the finance department write-up. I think it's the one you all have. Yes, it looks like. Assume that the first item is the renter credit on your handout.
Yes, it is. Page 4. Members.
Okay, this is the property tax refund program as it relates to the renters. Since 1997, we have actually started using an assumption about what portion of the rent payment it constitutes property taxes for purposes of the calculation of the property tax refund. Prior to 97, we used actual rent paid by tenants, but that was very cumbersome and administratively very complicated and costly. So in 1997, we assumed that 18% of the rent on the average apartment statewide constituted property taxes. In 1998, that was raised to 19%. And since then, and particularly since 2001, the property tax on apartment property has gone down dramatically as a result of classification rate changes and general levy reductions. And because of that, it's our view, based on studies we've done, that the percentage now, the appropriate percentage now, is 15%. The data actually might support a number slightly lower than that. But we are proposing that the percent of rent that is presumed to be property tax be changed from 19% to 15%. This will reduce the amount of the renter credit from an average of $550 to $465. It's our view that the portion of the rent credit that is above the actual property tax paid is in the form of a subsidy, really, for renters. And this is really not intended to be a general subsidy program. It's a property tax refund program. I think that is the argument for moving from 19 to 15%. It frees up that money for other priorities, including initiatives that would help renters through other areas of the budget. The fiscal impact of this is $30,400,000. And that would be in fiscal year 07. There's no impact in fiscal year 06. Are there any questions, Mr. Chair? I will presume that if I don't hear any, I'll just continue.
Let's just continue then.
And I may not wait very long, Mr. Chair. Second item on your list, hopefully, is the provision that would delay the reimbursement of the market value credit. This one, again, like many, requires a little history. In the 2003 legislature, as part of this budget solution to the $4.5 billion problem, as you know, we cut local government aid, and those local government aid cuts were permanent. At the same time, because of the way we did the cuts, we were trying to get a uniform budgetary impact across cities, and that required taking roughly an approximate equal percentage of every community's budget, not their aid, but their budget. And so for communities that did not have enough LGA to get to the targeted budget cut, we went into their market value credit. Now, the market value credit is different in character from the local government aid program. It's a reimbursement program for the homestead tax break that we've put into law. The local government aid program is a general aid program that is not in the nature of a reimbursement. It's more of a shared aid program. When we did the market value credit cuts, we were criticized because that was a temporary cut, while the LGA cuts were permanent. And that criticism, I think, is still out there. What this proposal does is basically delay what would have been a reimbursement, or I should say a reinstatement of the market value credit, which would have started in payable year 05. It delays that reimbursement for that reinstatement for 2 years. So it would, we would be restoring the market value credit cuts in 08, 09 rather than 06, 07. And the savings for that would be roughly $19 million a year. The next item in your packet is a more of a technical change related to the same issue, the market value credit. The way the current credit works, we pay 0.4% of market value. We pay that on behalf of the homesteads. The counties reduce the levy accordingly. That payment rises till value reaches $76,000 and then begins to phase out for values above $76,000, and eventually the credit disappears at about $411,000 of value. Because of the way the credit rises and then falls, we have a situation in that schedule where beyond the $76,000 cap, you could have a home that is has multiple owners, and we pay the credit based on the percentage of ownership. So you could have several owners, one of which resides in the property, and they could wind up getting a bigger market value credit than the comparable valued property that is 100% owned by the resident. So we think that to have a partial owner get a bigger credit than a full owner seems to be an odd result. This is easily fixed by changing how we calculate the credit by doing the credit based on as if it were 100% owned and then prorated based on the proportion of ownership. That's all we're doing there. That is a minor item fiscally. It's about $500,000 starting in fiscal year 07. I might add, Mr. Chair, that that was proposed last year by the governor and I think was in the House Omnibus Tax Bill. And I'll try to note that where I can remember it.
I'm sorry, Commissioner, Representative Lucchesi.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. And Commissioner Salamone, I should have asked you this on the last item, but we're still on market value credits. Can you tell me if the governor would be open to that subgroup of the communities who didn't get their market value credit, who also didn't receive LGA? A concern I've heard, particularly in the community I represent, is that in effect, the city councils were sort of given an unfunded mandate that there's not really truth in advertising here. The credit showed up to the taxpayer, yet you know it didn't take place from the state, so the city council had to make up the difference. Are you aware of the communities that I'm talking about and the concern there? It's a subgroup of this group, and while it wouldn't cost any money, it wouldn't change anything that the governor's proposing here. It would just, you know, in effect, keep those communities who are, quite frankly, just agitated by it, that they've been sort of forced to go along with something that really isn't taking place and it's perceived by the taxpayer that it is taking place. Do you think the governor would be open to language that would allow that to go away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, I want to be a little more clear about what your proposal would do. Could you restate it?
If I may, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Michael could talk about this a little bit. I'm actually trying to draft legislation with this right now, and it is a smaller group of cities And I think Mr. Hines who's maybe working on it, and it will continue to be a concern. I know some of the city groups are going to bring it forward, and I thought possibly they had met with the governor's office on this now, but it sounds like you have not heard of it.
Mr. Hines, you want to give us a brief explanation of what... No, you need to come down and... Come on. You have to come down so we can hear your voice on tape. Recorded for posterity, and as it's being piped throughout the universe here on the audio system.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski, the idea that Representative Lencheski and I have talked about is the idea of having the county auditor figure out in advance where this cut is going to occur so that the county auditor would adjust the credit subtraction from the property taxpayer's tax statement to reflect that they would not be getting the full market value credit. It would be a reduced credit in those communities so that there'd be a less of a credit shown and the city would come out whole, albeit that they would not get the market value credit, but the taxpayer would see the effect on the statement rather than just shorting the reimbursement check. And we haven't worked out the details yet, but that's the idea we've talked about, whether that could be done and how feasible that is.
Mr. Chair,
excuse me, just one second. Mr. Hines, do we have an idea of how many communities we're talking about with this concept?
Mr. Chairman, I just looked at that this morning. It's about 100 cities.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, what would the net effect be then to the taxpayer and to the city and to the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorman, the net effect to the state would be the same as now. The net effect to the taxpayer would be, I think it would depend on what the local jurisdiction does with that information that they're going. Right now, for instance, say the city of Bloomington is going to lose, I'm just picking a number at random, $1 million of market value homestead credit. Now, I think the way this works out is if Bloomington, in that case, chooses to add $1 million to their levy so that they'll still get the same amount of revenue, then I think this proposal probably is pretty similar, that they come out to get the full amount they want to get. They're not sort of, their budget doesn't come out short, albeit they have to add $1 million to their levy to what they really want to end up spending, versus if Bloomington was just going to really take a penalty or take a lesser property tax reduction, then Bloomington probably comes out differently under this proposal. And in the taxpayer's tax statement, again, that's where it would really depend on what the city of Bloomington chose to do to determine if the taxpayer comes out the same or not. So it's basically just taking that credit and saying the city isn't going to get reimbursed for it, so we're just not going to show the taxpayer. We're not going to subtract that from their statement. Their tax statement would be higher to reflect that they're not getting this credit.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Did we want the commissioner to respond to your idea, or you want to put another?
Well, I wanted to add, because it sounds like the commissioner has not heard about this till right now, and I guess where I was going along with this is thinking of the governor's proposal on the turbocharging of the truth in taxation or whatever. This is a truth in taxation issue in the sense that if we're trying to shine the light of accountability on the local units of government, and I know the chair has an interest in that, and there's been talk of the postcards being mailed out. This is one falsehood in the statement, and I would hope that if we're going to look at that, that we would also try to deal with this problem that, as Mr. Hines just said, 103 cities will face that will be an incorrect statement in their truth in taxation statements when they come out.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski. I'm doubtful the governor would be willing to sign on based on the fact that this was part in 2003. We did a combination of LGA cut and market value cut for uniformity purposes to have a budget cut that was fair. And this is sort of an extension of that for two more years. And so to the extent that the taxpayer does not get the credit and that it does not show up on the tax form, particularly that first item, I think the governor would be likely to oppose it. The point here was that when we did the 03 aid cuts, we were encouraging communities to make cuts in their budgets rather than raising their levies. And this is sort of a small version of raising the levy for that piece of the market value credit. So that on that basis, I'd be concerned about it. But we certainly can have those conversations with the governor and report back. I'm sure there will be a lot of conversations over the next few weeks about this whole issue of aid. And in the mix, maybe we'll find some way to address your concern.
Thank you, Commissioner. Let's continue on then.
The third item is relatively small. I believe the smallest item on the list. We have a senior deferral program for property taxes that provides a deferral for the portion of tax that exceeds 3% of their income. This affects about 120 seniors statewide, so it's not a terribly big program. This proposal would simply, under the current law, the base levy is qualified for this program, to be included on the program. This proposal would add special assessments and other charges that show up on the property tax statement to be included in the deferral calculation and in the deferral amount. So it is a relatively minor item. It would be a great simplification because we don't have to sort of separate out what the taxpayer wouldn't have to separate out what's deferrable and what isn't. So fairly minor item, administrative simplicity.
Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, before we move out of the property tax credits and refunds and deferrals, let me go back to the renter's credit and ask a couple questions quick. First, why did the administration choose to go to the 16% level in 2007 and 15% in subsequent years? Why not just one flat level?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I can answer that precisely. I think it had to do with the timing of other things in the governor's tax proposal. I don't know that would be a big issue. Maybe Jack has a perspective on it that I didn't. That I don't have.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Jack Manson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I think part of the thinking was as rents increase over time, that 15% is a larger number than 16% on a smaller number. So it kind of helps kind of phase in the cut to 15% this way.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Matson, or Commissioner, this program, as it was originally conceived some years ago, as you know, was meant to refund a portion of the property tax that was actually paid, or at least indirectly paid. And I guess at some point we said, we're not doing that anymore, we're going to just go with a percentage number because it's easier to administer. Then we've increased the percentage. Property taxes with property tax reform have gone down. What is the real percentage? If we were to take a percentage and say we want to get back to the pure concept of what this originally was, we want to just refund the implied indirect property taxes that are being paid, is it 15%? Is it 13%? As I've heard some say, what is it and how might that vary between jurisdictions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, we've been working a lot to try to figure that out, what that answer is. We sent out about 50,000 surveys to apartment owners to get feedback on that. We've talked to a number of the larger counties, and what we're seeing is that, data that suggests it's at least 15% or lower. And so because we're not sure yet the exact number, we're still tabulating surveys and might be able to come back and tell you a little more, with a little more precision what it is. But 15% for sure, and we thought that was adequate, at least at this point.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner, if I could one last time, then you say 15% or lower. Are you finding that it's maybe 15% in some counties, but it's lower in some others, or is it just too early to say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, that's part of the issue. Because this is a statewide average, we know there's variation around the average, and if we go for what we think is the lowest, we're going to have maybe more inequities in certain places. So it's good to be a little less aggressive on this for the sake of fairness across the state.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, at this point, Commissioner Salamone, you know, in my district I have a lot of apartment buildings that are occupied by very low-income senior citizens. And, you know, this check really helps them. In fact, I think I saw, can't remember which paper this morning, I almost started crying. Some elderly woman saying that a lot of her and her friends depend on this to buy, because they get it towards the end of the year to buy their Christmas presents and everything else, because they live paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, in my district, I've got three senior buildings just in the city of Virginia. Almost every city up there through their HRA has a what we call them senior apartments. Do you know, like, what the effect is going to be on our low-income seniors? Because I'm assuming that there are a lot of elderly that live in, maybe it's a range phenomena, but I'm assuming they're all over the state, and what the effect is going to be on them. And then I would guess, as a second part to that, you know, there's a formula here, as not only the percentage we're looking at and guesstimate on the 19 or 18 or 17 or whatever we want to use there as a guesstimate, but there is also an income tested type formula on this. There is also then on the circuit breaker. Why did the governor not choose then to, you know, nick homeowners like he's nicking apartment dwellers? Was that a, because I believe in the 2001 law, didn't we go up in income levels to close to maybe $80,000 before they're cut off? So, you know, if you're going to go after a senior in my district that's living on a $700 U.S. Steel pension check and probably $700 or $800 at the most in their Social Security, you're going to, why didn't you equalize it on the circuit breaker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, the homeowner portion of the circuit breaker is based on actual property taxes paid. So what we're proposing is to have the renter portion of the program be similar to that. It was set up to be similar to that. And the only problem was we started out with actual rents on the apartments, but that was very cumbersome administratively. And so we then moved to the percentage in 1997 as a simplification. The concept is to have the two be equivalent. In the first case, with the homeowners, it's actual rent, actual property tax. They take it right off of their statement. With the renters, they don't have a property tax statement, so they don't have the ability to do that. And so the proposal, actually, as we are making it, would bring more fairness between homeowners and renters, in the sense that we are using a number for the renters that's more indicative of what the property tax really is.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, fairness, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder. To back my question that I asked, do you know what the average income like is of a renter in this state? And you know, do you know what the effect is going to be on this reduction on low income, not only seniors but low income folks? And I don't know how the formula, what the correlation is between the circuit breaker versus the renter's credit, whether it's a 15 or 16 or 18% then on the homeowners that you're trying to get that number down to on the circuit breaker. But it would seem to me that for us to philosophically be fair here, we would, if we're going to be going after and reducing this to save money for the state and shifting basically more, increasing the property tax, if you want to call it that, on these renters, that then we should do the same to the homeowners. Because, you know, I mean, I'm sure that the average income of these renters, if you took an average, is significantly lower than $80,000 a year, which we go up to before you start phasing out the renter's credit. So, you know, I'd be curious. To me, it seems maybe something that the administration looked at. If you could find out for me the average, could you also find out for me how many renters are Democrats and how many are Republicans? Because there seems to be a philosophy coming out of the governor's office where he's going after people that basically, let's be honest, don't vote for him. And these probably, there would be a correlation here too, because I'm sure most of those people on Minnesota Care don't vote for him. And
Representative Rick, even if you check record, the majority of people didn't vote for the governor, so you're
I'm right. I know.
Correct. Sure. But anyway.
That's right. But so. Then again, mandates are mandates, you know. So. And then us in the BI had to be older. So, Mr. Chair, if the commissioner could, maybe he could also, while he's looking for the average income of a renter, he could look to see what the average political persuasion is, too. But that might be a little harder, but I would appreciate information on the first request.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rugovino, I don't have the data with me that could get us that income number. We can get that for you. To your point about the low-income renters, I'll go back to my statement that this right now the program is part property tax reimbursement or co-payment refund and part subsidy for renters. And I don't think it was ever intended to be a subsidy for rent. Now, that doesn't change the reality of what's happening to the elderly, low-income person you mentioned. But the point was that if we take this to the correct level, that would represent the property tax reimbursement, it frees up money that could be then used in other places in the budget to help that very taxpayer. I know we've had a lot of conversations before this proposal was finalized with the folks at the Housing Finance Agency and other groups that advocate for low-income renters. You need to have a conversation with them, I think, about what this will do. But they're looking for more funds to help out low-income renters. And I think the governor has some, I'm not very conversant with it, but I think there are some initiatives in the area of homelessness and homeless other programs targeted at people with high housing costs, low-income people. So it's a question of redeploying these funds, the surplus or subsidy portion of the program, into other areas of the state budget.
Well, listen, there, you know, there are priorities, and we all have different priorities. And you know, you're a numbers cruncher, and you're very good at it, and you're very well versed in taxes in this state. You're an expert, and I will admit that freely here, publicly. But, you know, your idea and definition on the governor's and probably a lot of members of this table are different than my ideas of what priority is. And for me, a priority is not to take Christmas away from low-income senior citizens, like I saw the one lady said today in the paper. So some of you that want to take Christmas away from low-income seniors, you go ahead. I know Representative Davids would not want to. I can just tell by the way he's looking at me that he would not want to take Christmas away from Grandma. So, you know, we'll prioritize this as we go, but
maybe
he might want to take her tires away, but he doesn't want to take Christmas away.
All right. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, could you clarify some confusion I think there is here about the income limits for the issue of renter's credit versus circuit breaker? There's an implication here that that they're one and the same. Can you clarify that?
Mr. Chair, I think the renter's credit is more generous than the homestead, the homeowner portion of it. We certainly can get the data for you that compares the income and the various caps at each income level for the PTR program. I don't have that information here.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Lanning, I believe staff could answer the question if you want them to. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's not a simple answer to this. As the commissioner stated, in one sense, the renter's program is more generous in that at the lower end of the schedule, it provides for essentially larger refunds when you look at the income of the renter relative to the assumed property tax that's being paid. On the other hand, as Representative Rukovina pointed out, he's also correct in that the homeowners program has higher maximums and it allows higher income. people to get it in. It's basically the I don't have the exact amounts because they're indexed, and so when you look in the statute, you can't know exactly what they are. But in general, the renter's credit income limit reaches its maximum in the low $40,000 range, whereas the homeowner's goes up to roughly $80,000. But the renter's formula is more generous at the lower end. So that's the sort of complex answer to the question.
Mr. Chair, on the same issue.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Salamone, just out of curiosity, could you also, you or perhaps maybe staff can do it, show me a map on how that distribution of what's the total here there? The renter's credit of $143 million last year was distributed metro versus rural versus how the circuit breakers distributed in total metro versus rural, because I just kind of got a sneaky hunch that the circuit breaker is probably metro heavily weighted and just the opposite maybe on the renters. Maybe they both are, I don't know, but just another one of my paranoid assumptions, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Okay, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, in the interlude between when I asked to be recognized and now, I've gone from one question to two. No, I'm leaving my grandmother out of this. Representative Rukavina. The issue that Representative Lanning just touched on, and I appreciate his raising it, of the differential treatment of homeowners and renters in the two programs, I'm wondering if either staff or the department can speak to the interplay of the homeowners having access not only to the circuit breaker but also the mortgage interest tax deduction, and while the renters receive credit only for imputed property tax paid, and if that that interplay for the homeowner doesn't actually more level the playing field.
Commissioner, you want to take a swing at that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think with a little research we could get to what you're getting at, so you can see the trade-offs between those two. It's a legitimate question, but I don't think we can inform you very much today on that. I think some of the data that we put together for our incident study might help with getting at that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chair, if I may. I'd appreciate anything the department or staff can provide to assist me in better understanding that interplay. I appreciate the commissioner's interest in getting to the correct level of property tax paid as a portion of rent. My impressions are that over the last several years, with the downturn in the economy, rents have essentially plateaued out. At least in the metro area, from observing there, slight increase, but probably below inflation in most sectors of that market. And yet, for instance, the administration has identified that the governor's proposals in the education area will mean a 23% increase in property taxes. And I'm wondering if this drive down to 16 and then 15% may even be a correct level now, but with a flat market for rent and an increase, governor's proposed increases in property taxes, we won't actually see the percentage of rent, which is property tax, increase for renters. And that 16 or 15 may be accurate today, but by the end of the biennium may be too low. And I'm wondering if the commissioner could speak to that.
Commissioner, I think it's important to distinguish the effect of a general rise in levies that affects all properties proportionately from shifts between classes of property that might be induced by changes in class rates, for example. And a lot of the reduction, or a good portion, I can't tell you what percentage, of the reduction in the renter property tax is a result of classification rate changes aggressively done during the last few years leading up to 2001. So you raise a legitimate point. I think we have to continue to monitor the relationship between property taxes and rent over time, because this percentage will not be correct for necessarily for a longer period of time. It will vary from year to year. So one might expect that over time, if property taxes on rental property rise dramatically relative to other properties, we might want to come back and look at this percentage. But if it's rising because all property taxes are rising, I think that we address that with general aid to cities, counties, and schools, and that becomes a general aid issue rather than a circuit breaker issue.
Thank you.
Representative Zellers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I actually was thinking along the same lines as Representative Rucavina.
That is a dangerous thought, yes.
And he left, thank God, not to have this hanging over me. Commissioner, and maybe it's for Commissioner or staff, I was also curious about the distribution throughout the state, not necessarily metro versus suburban. And then I was also curious if there was an age breakdown, if it's grouped categorically by age.
Political persuasion too, Representative?
No, I don't want to go that far down. But I'm curious about some of the rental properties around the metropolitan area that have folks that have moved into the city who maybe necessarily haven't bought a home yet, but are getting this credit. Because although Representative Rucavina is here, I do know a girl, and she's a Democrat who's taking advantage of that credit. So I'm curious if there's a breakdown age-wise.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that would be difficult. I don't think we have data by age. We certainly can provide data metro versus rural distribution of all kinds of things, and we can certainly do that for the circuit breaker and show the renters separately from the homeowners. I will remind the committee that the parameters of the circuit breaker program are statewide parameters. We don't have anything in the formula that is unique to rural versus metro. So to the extent that the distribution is different between rural and metro, it will be a reflection of where the renters are who qualify for the program. So with that caveat, we can try to get you the data that you're asking for.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Thank you, Chairman.
Okay, Commissioner, we can move off of aids and credits. We can continue on, or go off of property taxes. I'm sorry, we can... I think the next item is on page 8, members.
And hopefully, Mr. Chair, it's the political contribution refund that you're looking at.
It's, I see the Representative Rookerville has now left the room. We're talking about his particular subsidies. But anyway.
Mr. Chair, members, you'll remember in the 2003 budget proposal of the governor, we proposed eliminating the political contribution credit program. This is a program that by which taxpayers can make contributions to qualifying candidates up to $50 per person or $100 per couple, and the money is then refunded to them by the state based on certain documentation that they get from the candidate, which is then submitted to the Department of Revenue. Basically, this program effectively donates general fund money to political candidates, and the governor had proposed in 2003 as part of the budget solution then that we eliminate this program. It raises or saves about $10.5 million for the old 607 biennium. So we're bringing that proposal forward to you again as part of the solution to this year's budget. Mr. Chair, the next item is a proposal to have quarterly withholding on non-resident partnerships and S corporations. Currently, most taxpayers pay their income tax to Minnesota throughout the year through estimated payments and withholding. But in the case of non-resident partnerships and S corps that have taxpayers having Minnesota source income, we don't receive payments on those on behalf of those persons until the tax returns are filed at the end of the year. This proposal would put the non-resident partnerships and S corps on the same pay-as-you-go basis as our resident taxpayers. This raises $15.1 million in the 06-07 biennium. It's essentially a shift. In the out years, it's roughly a $900,000 effect per year.
Representative Rukavina, you missed talking about your welfare elimination for the in the governor's proposals to eliminate the political contribution refund program. So,
Mr. Chair,
there go your Christmas present.
I'll never get anybody to give any money to me anymore. But, Mr. Chair, I think, Mr. Chair, that you guys get a lot more money than us on that. It's another. Can you break that down into Democrat and Republican?
I think that is easily available.
But, Mr. Chair, could I, one, just before we leave this department and renter's credit discussion?
Representative Rukavina, we've already left that.
Well, I ran. I'm sorry. I heard.
But Representative Rukavina, we'll have, what we're trying to do here is afford the commissioner and the department an opportunity to go through the entirety of what the governor's proposal is. We'll have many more hours of discussion, I'm sure, on each one of these individual items in the governor's budget proposal. So we don't.
Thank you.
We'll have lots of time, Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, then
put that in your packet.
I'll put this in the save part with Governor Carlson's quote.
That's good. That's good.
I've got it all in the save material part.
And besides, Representative Rukavina, with the information, additional information that the department hopefully can provide us, we'll maybe have some additional facts on which to have the discussion. So, okay, Commissioner, let's continue then. I think we're on page 10.
Next item, Mr. Chair and members, is another withholding proposal dealing with contractors. One of our ongoing problems is the difficulty in collecting income from independent contractors. And this proposal would require that general contractors or any company hiring independent contractors withhold 2% of their payments to such contractors for withholding. This would operate similar to what we do with other taxpayers. The contractors would be required to issue a 1099 for documentation. They would be subject to the same de minimis, I think it's a $600 de minimis on the issuance of 1099s. So this would get us a way to track taxpayers who, in many cases, operate on a cash basis. It's sort of close. It's our small way of making a little dent in what we call the tax gap last time I was here yesterday. So it's a compliance issue that we think would help the department considerably.
Yeah, Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, how does this work mechanically? So if you issue a 1099, if you're issuing it to a company that's a C corporation, does the money go into the corporate income tax box at the Department of Revenue when it's turned in? If it's going to a sole proprietor, does it go into the individual income tax box? And if it is issued to a partnership, does it go into some other box? How does this work?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I think I'll have Jack Manson respond.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Knobloch, I don't believe there would be any withholding for a C-Corp because they're not subject to the individual income tax. This is just for individual sole proprietors. Also, S-Corps would be taxed as it flows through to the individual level. So this would only apply to sole proprietors, either residents or non-residents, not to an entity level.
Mr. Chair, so it would only apply to individuals. It doesn't apply to a business that's incorporated either as an S-Corp, a C-Corp, an LLC, or is it registered as a partnership?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nava, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Salamone, following along with what Representative Knobloch said, you know, I can't see that this is doable. I think we considered this a couple of years ago and just thought it was too problematic. So I just think the department would have one heck of a time trying to implement this. But, you know, this is one of the shifts in the governor's budget, and I know that we'll get to the car leasing, upfronting, and the accelerating the revenues for cigarettes from the wholesaler to the distributor. And I think there's some other, I don't want to use the inflammatory words of gimmick, but there are a number of shifts going on in this budget. If the committee and the House thought this was one to include, what's the total millions that are in the shifts in the tax section?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, this particular one, the withholding on contractors, is not a shift. This is just a compliance item. So it's $2 million per year. The one before it, the withholding on the non-resident partnerships and S-Corps, was substantially a shift, $14.2 million with the $900,000 ongoing.
Mr. Chair, with the...
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the other accelerated revenues, I guess, would be the neutral way to call them without being inflammatory. But shifts are moving money up through the tax system to get the money quicker, which is really what it is. What is the dollar figure in the governor's proposal in total as we go through these?
For
all of the upfronting, accelerating the revenues. How many millions is it combined with all the different provisions we have today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, I think the two biggest pieces would be the cigarette and the vehicle leases. Beyond that, I'm trying to remember what the other ones are. I don't have a total for all the shifting. But substantially less than certainly what we did in 2003.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Lucheski.
Thank you. Just in closing in that, wasn't it true that the cigarette shift and the car lease shift was included in last year's House tax bill?
I believe so.
But the previous one you just went through was not and had been rejected by this committee?
I believe that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Mr. Manson, wouldn't it be a lot easier for compliance on this if the state required these businesses to file our own version of a 1099 with the state? And wouldn't that also accelerate the way that we could pick up revenue from that? From what I'm reading, all we're getting is full data off of federal.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think we just wanted to avoid a duplicate filing of the 1099s. I don't know if there was any discussion at the department of having them file a separate 1099 for Minnesota or not. I'm not aware of any discussion like that. So.
Mr. Chairman, I thought what the object was is to pick up some lost possible revenue and also to speed up what we are getting.
Let's continue then, Commissioner, page 12.
Next item is a new proposal involving a credit for dairy farmers. It's a non-refundable credit. The governor's concerned that we support and promote investments in our dairy industry in Minnesota. This would be a credit of 10% up to $30,000. And that would be $30,000 would be a 6-year maximum for any taxpayer. It would apply to investments in capital, purchases of depreciable assets other than farm animals. This is a cost of $2.9 million for the biennium.
Okay.
Next item is a more of an equity item. It would provide a full deduction for long-term health insurance premiums, and it would remove an inequity between self-employed taxpayers and other taxpayers. Currently, self-employed taxpayers get a deduction for their long-term health premiums and a tax credit of 25% of the premiums paid, so they get the deduction and the 25% credit. Other taxpayers get the deduction for long-term health insurance only to the extent that they itemize deductions. They also qualify for the credit, but the credit is reduced by the amount of deduction that they take for the same insurance premiums. this proposal would treat all taxpayers like we currently treat self-employed taxpayers. And that has a cost of $630,000 for the biennium. Next item is federal... I'm sorry,
Representative Knobloch.
Quickly, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Salamone, how much of a tax credit would we still be incurring each year once this proposal is implemented?
The total cost of the credit?
Yes.
We'd have to report that back to you, Mr. Representative Knobloch. Maybe Jack has that number. I don't.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, just so I could understand the question, you mean now that we're allowing the full deduction, what would the impact be on the credit then, the use of the credit then?
Right. How much of a credit, how much of the cost of the credit per year, what would that still be? If you could get that to me, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, the next item is the federal conformity. As you, I think, remarked yesterday, and that we've had several federal tax bills for which we have not yet passed conforming legislation. The governor's proposal includes conformity on the vast majority of those provisions, notable exceptions being the we are not proposing conformity to the increase in the standard deduction that's contained in the working family tax relief bill. We are not proposing conformity with the U.S. production activity deduction, which is contained in the American Jobs Creation Act. Those are two very big pieces that are quite expensive. Most of the other provisions, there may be a few minor exceptions, we are proposing that we conform to the federal legislation. This will be ultimately will allow us to have continued simplification in our tax, avoid complications, I guess is a better way to say it, and something we should do, and that will be that is before you,
Commissioner. What if we were going to go in the direction of federal conformity across the board? What would those? What would the numbers? What are the best estimates you have as far as numbers?
Mr. Chair, we'll have to also get that. I'm sorry, we'll have to get that for you. We have those figures. I'm recalling the standard deduction, maybe Jack, about $40 million a year. It's a fairly large number.
And then obviously I presume you have that broken down with each portion of the code.
Mr. Chair, Jack has the sheet that has the breakout.
Mr. Chairman, for the standard deduction increase for married couples for the first biennium, that would be an additional cost of approximately $57 million. And for the other large piece, the deduction for U.S. production activities, that would be approximately $35 million in the 06-07 biennium.
I'm sorry, again, the number again was...
$35 million for the deduction for U.S. production activities. The other large piece is to extend the increased expensing provisions, which we kind of conform to partially, but the full conformity would be about $50 million on that piece for 06-07.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Rukavina.
Chair, Commissioner Salamone, yesterday the CPAs from around the state were at the Capitol, and the one from my district was talking about their initiatives, I believe, were the alternative minimum tax conformity for that, and then the death tax, these are the estate tax, and we're not proposing either of those.
Mr. Chair, at this point, no. It's a question of priorities. I think there are. We've had a lot of conversations with the Minnesota CPA Society, and I know it's their number one priority to get us in line to reduce the AMT and also the get conformity with the estate tax. We simply given everything else on the table, have not been able to fit that into the proposal. We expect we will hear proposals from the legislature, and it's not a philosophical issue. It's just a question of priorities.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm relieved to hear that, because I believe this year the federal state tax exemption goes to $1.5 million. It keeps going up over the next few years, but mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, we don't really conform with our death tax, which is the old lien law, which we implemented a few years ago, because I don't think they do that on a federal level. But maybe somebody can take that death tax off the books here in Minnesota this year. We'll help Representative David's grandma again on that one.
It would be, I think we all realize that for the sake of people who are computing their taxes and trying to, those CPAs that were here yesterday trying to figure out federal tax and then have to obviously do add-backs and other calculations for state taxes would be obviously much easier if we could have total federal conformity, but unless somebody starts coming up with a new way to manufacture money around here, the bigger, faster printing press by the paper
budget
is on the way. So, anyway, let's continue then, Commissioner. I think we're on page 15.
Chair, the next item is one that was proposed by the governor in the past. Was, I believe, in the House and Senate bills last year, and this would provide a tax break for National Guard troops who are in full-time service in Minnesota. It would exempt income earned by members while on active duty in Minnesota. It makes the treatment consistent with the treatment of the military pay from federal activation. It would affect 850 returns, providing a benefit of about $880 per taxpayer. Cost of that is $84,000 for the biennium, so it's relatively inexpensive. Next item relates to the bioscience zone legislation that we passed. When this was passed in, I believe it was 2003, we capped the benefits of the biozone tax benefits at $1 million for the 0405 biennium. Unlike the Job Z program, that was not there was no cap to the appropriations there. This proposal would simply add would extend that cap or apply it to the 0607 biennium. So we're providing another $1 million worth of benefits for bioscience zones for the 0607 biennium. The next item relates to the proposal for an international development zone, similar in character to the Job Z program. I believe this item, Mr. Chair, was also in the House and Senate bill last year. It creates an international development zone with certain tax benefits similar to the Job Z program. It would be administered by the Department of Economic Development, Trade and Economic Development. Actually, that's an old acronym, DEED, I should say. It would be, we think it would provide a state-of-the-art air cargo consolidation and shipping zone conveniently located near the Minnesota, Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. The cost for this program is $700,000 for the biennium. Next item relates to foreign operating corporations. Last year, the governor and the House and the Senate had provisions in their bills to tighten up the use of the foreign operating corporation provision. This provision relates to domestic companies who have operations outside the U.S. The governor's proposal would require that foreign operating corporations have a substantial presence in a foreign country by requiring that 80% of their property and payroll be outside the U.S. It also requires a de minimis amount of $2 million in property outside the U.S. and $1 million in payroll. The proposal also allows for partnership factors to flow up to the parent for the calculation of these de minimis amounts. We also, as you know, are currently trying to accelerate our audits, looking closely at these the use of the foreign operating corporation. I can tell you, and I'm sure all of you know this, that the foreign operating corporation provision is very complex. Corporate finance is very complex, and so we are moving cautiously to try to identify where the abuse is and to try to treat it as surgically as we can. And this will be a big issue for us working through the rest of the legislative session.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I don't see the specifics in this, and I admit I can't remember all the specifics from the Senate tax proposal last year. How does this compare to that one, both in specifics plus in amount of dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullerly, this proposal is essentially the governor's 2004 proposal with we're allowing for the partnership factors to be included in calculating the de minimis amount of property and payroll. The Senate proposal was quite extensive. It basically took out the foreign operating provision and the foreign royalty deduction. So it was our view then, last year, that that was a bit too ambitious. In fact, basically wiped out the benefit that was put in place in 1988 for companies that had foreign operations. And in 88, we were trying to treat an inequity between companies that had real foreign subsidiaries versus those that simply had were not incorporated outside the U.S. In terms of numbers, right now the proposal has $2.3 million. The Senate numbers, I think, were in the neighborhood of 50 to 60 million. They're quite high.
Thank you.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I actually have a question for you on this provision. I know you don't know what you'll do yet in your this bill, but I do have a lot of very specific questions about this provision, and I think most people would be put to sleep. And so, you know, I guess I'm just wondering if we're going to spend time on this, and that would be something that your caucus would decide. I guess, how do you propose we really spend substantive time on this issue? I think this is a very complicated issue. This background information doesn't begin to get at what's really happening in this provision. And some of the things the commissioner just said, I agree with, the 80%, for example. But I think this number is way too low, personally, to just come up with 2.3. Like what stated the Senate last year, the 50, and I think that realistically, if we end up spending time on this provision in the spirit of bipartisanship, I think the House would want to try to find a little more than 2.3. So I just wonder how you might proceed on dealing with these FOC provisions, if, just how you intend to spend time as a committee on this provision.
Well, first and foremost, obviously, we'll go into this issue in some further depth. I have stated before, and will say to the committee, I think that if we are going to spend a considerable amount of time trying to determine what may or may not be happening during the next several months, prior to the department's additional information that they may glean from audit, I think we're just going down the path of perhaps trying to change tax policy when we don't know what's actually happening. I don't know what the department's timetable is and what information they believe they'll glean from the additional audits, but again, I don't think we can we can debate it ad nauseum and come up with what we think is going on, but I'm certainly not a corporate tax expert. I don't know how many, I don't think we have too many sitting around the table. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to make policy without fact. I don't think that's a good direction to go in. And I don't also don't think that we should be trying to back into a number. In other words, in order to balance the budget, we think, well, we need another $10 million, so let's see if we can change corporate tax policy to come up with another $10 million. If we have what we would agree are sound and reasonable assumptions that we can go on, great, let's change policy. But let's not charge off trying to find more money just because we believe perhaps there are corporations who are taking substantive advantage of this particular provision in law. So, Commissioner, can you give us a concept of what your increased audit timetable is and what information you may be able to give the legislature based on those audits?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I can give you a specific timetable. We know there are 1,100 corporations that use the dividend received deduction, which is part of the FOC calculation, and there those 1,100 comprise about 115 unitary groups, so it's really 115 families of companies, and we do tax on a uniformity basis. That what am I trying to say here? Combined reporting. We tax the group of families, so we catch all the intercompany transactions. These audits are very complicated. It takes our folks a long time to sort out and try to figure out what's really going on. So I would we'll share with you what we can, and as we learn it, we'll share it with you. These are very time-consuming audits, and I'm sure we won't be done auditing 2 months from now. It's an ongoing process. Jack, who's a little more close to this end of the department, might have more to add to that. But
Mr. Chairman, we're currently auditing a lot of these companies, but they're in various stages of either initial review or they're actually an ongoing field audit right now, or else some are even in our appeals level. So, obviously, we can't disclose, you know, on a case-by-case basis, so it'll take some time to have some aggregate information on that. So, but they're on various stages right now of development.
Okay. All right, thank you. Members, obviously, there is a significant difference of, at least there was last year, difference of policy or intent to change tax law based on some different perspectives. So I'm sure we'll have some of the same debate again this year. Representative Lucheski.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you sharing with us, Mr. Chair, what you're thinking on this, because I think you're right. There are people who are trying to back into a number on this, and I think if the House doesn't want to, that's a laudable goal, but I think the Senate's going to. And the governor is spending time on it. I mean, he's put it in his budget, so he wants to spend time on it, obviously. So while the House may decide, and I agree with you, Mr. Chair, that, you know, we just don't have enough information, we don't know where these audits are going, but the governor has made it important enough to get into this bill. So, you know, I don't know where we go with that as it relates to information coming out. I know that the Hutchinson case is still out there, and I had heard that it's possible that we will hear information on that court case soon. That would be another argument, I think, Mr. Chair, to delay. But I do think if, you know, you have stated before that we need to, you know, not just kill ourselves in all these little nuances and get to a bill and get something out there, and I agree with that completely. However, if the governor is going to be pushing something here and he's laid it out, and the Senate is as well, if you were to determine, or the, you know, the Republican House were to determine this is something we should spend time on, you know, I would hope that there would be an effort to try to pull together those legislators who maybe have a significant interest in this, and instead of wasting committee time, find a way to have us get you know, spend time on this. The CPAs are visiting on us on this. The chamber is. There are a lot of interested groups who do want to spend time on it. And I think it's a little premature, but I think we're going to be facing it.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, given what you just said to Representative Lucheski, that you don't want to back into money on this committee here, are you going to get to see the $200 million the governor's backing into? Or is it going to come to this committee even? Or are we full? Are we backing into that?
There's a difference between backing in and making up, Representative Rukavina. We'll let you determine which one is which.
You're going to be in trouble.
All right. Commissioner, let's move off of foreign operating corporations and page 20.
Mr. Chair, the next item is another one that was in the governor's bill, the House bill, and the Senate bill last year. This relates to the single sales apportionment for corporate income. I think the members have heard about that, but for the new members, let me say that we use a three-factor basis for assigning corporate income to Minnesota. We use the percent of property in Minnesota, the percent of payroll in Minnesota, and the percent of sales. Those three percentages are then weighted. In some cases, states weight them equally. In recent years, states have moved toward weighting the sales factor more heavily than the property and payroll. Minnesota currently is at 75% weight on the sales and 12.5% on the other two factors. And that 10-20 years ago would have been pretty ambitious, with the exception of Iowa, which has had 100% weight since 1933. But recently, states in the Midwest, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, have moved that percentage up. A few of them are now, seven of them are now at 100% weight. And when you put more weight on the sales factor, you basically untax effectively the property and payroll, providing a benefit for companies who substantially invest in Minnesota, gives them more incentive to substantially invest here rather than other places. We think it's a good competitive item. What the governor is proposing, because of the fiscal constraints, is proposing an 8-year phase-in from 75% to 100%, starting after December 31st, 2006. This particular phased-in schedule would have the cost be $1.8 million in the 06-07 biennium. A sidebar on this, Mr. Chair, is that when states like Wisconsin and Illinois adopt this, they essentially increase the tax on companies that are not substantially invested in their state but selling into it. And so they've effectively imposed a tax increase on our companies by virtue of their enacting this provision in their state.
And Commissioner, is this the similar or same proposal that was in the House and Senate tax bills last year?
Mr. Chair, I think it was similar to the House provision. In the Senate, it was an immediate move to 100%, and there were some strings attached to it. The most notable one was, and maybe it's the only one, that they adopted a throwback rule, meaning for purposes of calculating the sales factor, if you had sales that were not taxable, those were pulled into Minnesota and counted toward the Minnesota sales factor. That provision, that attachment to the provision, clawed back a substantial amount of the relief that would otherwise come from the 100% factor.
Okay. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, when we've been hearing this proposal in the past, it was claimed that we would end up with more tax money because of this. Now, because of all the more jobs we would have and we'd be getting more money. Is that taken into account in this, or is it not taken into account, or does it take so many years to have an effect? Or,
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullerly, the $1.8 million certainly doesn't have a sort of dynamic economic component to it. It's just the direct cost in terms of lost corporate tax revenue in 06-07. By the way, the ongoing cost when it's fully phased in is in the neighborhood of $40 or $50 million a year. But none of those numbers include the economic benefit from having Minnesota be a more attractive place to headquarter a large company. when this was originally proposed, we talked about, there were estimates of how many jobs might be created over some period of time, and I think they were in the neighborhood of 30 to 40,000. But the timeline was sort of unspecified. I'm thinking of a specific study done by a professor at the University of Chicago who was sort of specialized in studying this kind of thing. So we know it will have a jobs impact over time, and it's intuitive. If you get more companies to establish their operations in Minnesota, that means more payroll, more income taxes. It means more property taxes and so on. So there's a larger economic benefit that's not reflected in these numbers.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Let's continue then, page 21.
Next item is, again, one of the items from the 03 session and 04 session. I think last year it was in both the Governor, House, and Senate bills. This is the provision that would accelerate the payment on vehicle leases. Rather than treating a lease as a series of monthly sales, we simply treat it as a single sale and collect all of the sales tax on those monthly payments. At the front end of the lease, we would exempt vehicles over 10,000 pounds. In this year's version of the proposal, we are providing refunds for leases terminated within 90 days or when the vehicle is returned to the manufacturer under the Lemon Laws. We also provide a credit for taxes paid to another state if the state had previously been taxed on the lease payments in another state. This item does have a significant first-year shift element to it. We're booking $42.6 million from this. There's probably some compliance increase as well. So the fiscal year 06 number is 27.1, fiscal 07, 15.5 million. Many states already do this. I think I was told that most states treat leases this way.
Commissioner, might be helpful, although we've been through this last year, to give us an update on which states already do this versus states that are not doing this particular method of sales tax collection.
Mr. Chairman, I can add that of the states that do, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio are considering.
Did they have pending legislation, you're saying?
No, they all treat it as an upfront.
Oh, they do. Okay. Okay, Commissioner, page 22.
Another item in all the bills last year, this was a proposal to move the sales tax on cigarettes from the retail level to the distributor level, and this is motivated by compliance concerns in the Department of Revenue. We have obviously many retail cigarette distributors, thousands of them, but we have relatively few distributors, and so by moving the tax from retail, the wholesale will get, we think, much better compliance. This would be basically a gross receipts tax at the distributor level. We would estimate the markup from wholesale to retail and try to approximate or set the tax rate to get us exactly or as close as we can get the same amount of revenue we would have gotten from a retail tax at the tax at the retail level. We did a sample some time ago about 25, we looked at 25 completed audits of cigarette retailers and found $40 million of unreported sales, representing about $3.3 million of tax, penalty, and interest, averaging about $131,000 per audit. So we think this is a good thing to do from that perspective. It does bring in, there is a shift component here as well. It's $5.8 million. And then the annual gain from compliance is about $2.5 million.
And, Commissioner, was this another item that would have been in your tax gap?
Mr. Chair, no? Certainly that would be a small piece of it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
I'm getting here, and Representative Lucheski had asked it earlier, but Commissioner, you know, and I'm looking at the differences when you're and the accelerations that you have in the bill, say on the quarterly withholding for the S Corps and this the motor vehicle acceleration and the cigarette sales, and I add it up to what it levels out at then, and I get about $64 million. So, is it really, you know, in the next biennium, are we another $64 million out of whack by counting this up front, or?
Chair, there is currently a projected structural balance in 08-09, I think, of about $740 million. So I don't think this is certainly a lot less one-time money than we had to deal with in the 04-05 budget problem, the 03 session.
But I mean, okay, so the year is out, Mr. Chair, then you just, when you count it at 1-4, let's say, in the sales tax, then that's the realistic count. So there isn't a more structural deficit built in by accelerating.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, to the extent this is one time, the shift part is one-time money, so it wouldn't be showing up, obviously, in the 08-09 biennium. So whatever the situation is in the 08-09, it certainly would be, if you say the number is $60 million, it would be $60 million worse off because of the fact that if we didn't do this,
you'd have more income.
You'd have more in the 08-09 by that amount, but it's relatively small relative to the structural balance that we see there now.
But you'll be getting the gambling money to balance it all again. So.
Page 23.
This next item, again, was in all bills last year, and I think it's really a no-brainer. As you know, we're struggling with the collection of the use tax, the sales tax on out-of-state purchases. And at the same time, we buy things from out-of-state vendors. We, as a state government, buy things from out-of-state vendors, some of whom, perhaps, don't pay the use tax. And so this provision would say that if you're going to sell to the state of Minnesota, and specifically to the executive or legislative branch, we've exempted the higher education and the judicial branch. If you're going to sell to the state of Minnesota, you need to register and collect the use tax. And we've worked out the mechanics with the Department of Administration, and it would be, again, a small contribution toward the tax gap of $3.4 million for the biennium. There are a number of states, I think about 9 states, that already do this, and more are being encouraged to do it. Next item is also an item from past bills. I think it was in both House and Senate bills last year. This would reverse the decision in the Great Lakes pipeline case. This was a case involving the question of whether pipelines in the movement of gas and other things through pipe constituted industrial production, and if it constitutes industrial production, then the capital equipment purchases are subject to the capital equipment refund, and certain sales, purchases are also exempt from the sales tax. This provision would simply reverse that court decision and clarify that for purposes of taxation, gas company pipelines does not constitute industrial production.
Commissioner DeVee, correct? It's not a clarification, it's a change.
Well, so, Mr. Chair, when we lose cases, it's usually because someone's opinion of what the legislature intended is different from what we think it was. And this establishes what we think the original intent of the law was. And you get to decide whether we're right or not, I guess, and how you treat this item.
Page 25.
The next two items relate to something the legislature did in 2001 when
it was thought that because of the streamlined sales tax project, and I think most members are aware of the streamlined sales tax project. This is the multi-state effort to try to get our sales taxes to be more common in definitions and administrative procedures. That project is proceeding and probably will eventually reach a conclusion in the next 18 to 24 months. It was deemed in 2001, it was felt in 2001 that, and we were under the impression that our existing 6.2% tax on short-term vehicle leases, this is an add-on sales tax that we place on rentals of less than 28 days. It was felt that that tax and our 2.5% additional tax on alcoholic beverages, we thought that those were, we were led to believe that those were in compliance, in conflict with the streamlined sales tax definitions, and that we would have to sort of repeal those in order to get into conformity with the streamlined sales tax project. So in 2001, the legislature passed legislation saying we need to find a replacement for those taxes. The Department of Revenue was directed to study those two items and to come back to the legislature, I believe it was last year, or in 2003, I can't remember, reporting to the legislature how those taxes might be changed in order to get into compliance with the streamlined sales tax definitions. Since then, we've learned in the case of the 6.2% tax on short-term car rentals, that we no longer have a problem with that. The streamlined sales tax took that out and said that that was not part of the agreement. The agreement didn't cover short-term car leases. The tax is currently scheduled to expire at the end of December of this year, and we are proposing that it be extended now that we understand that there was never a there is not a conflict with the streamlined sales tax project. So extending that tax, removing the sunset, would raise $19.3 million for the biennium. This is the revenue that would have come in otherwise had we not gotten into the situation thinking we had a problem with it.
Okay. Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Salamone, just a clarification. Are you removing the sunset provision or extending it?
We are we're extending the tax. We're removing the sunset.
Okay. Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke and Commissioner Salamone. Representative Rukavina and Anderson, I think Knobloch, and I'm not sure who else would have been there. Probably Representative Krenke, I'm not sure. We had a big, wonderful debate in Ways and Means last year about the stadium. And I think that was, I had heard it through local gov and taxes. I think it was, this happened in Ways and Means. And it was Representative Rukavina took this money and took the next item's money and said, let's, you know, do the stadium that way. And it was a 13-13 vote, and everybody was tracking it, and this was the money that was going to build the stadium, this and the next provision, or fill the final hole for the state. And at that time, we had heard, now, and maybe I have this incorrect, and I certainly know you can't always speak for everybody in the governor's office, but we had heard at that time that would be using a tax increase to build a stadium. So now it's showing, it's, we're using it here in the budget. And can you maybe say what's changed there? I mean, that was part of, and you know, I'm not arguing for stadium here. I actually voted no. But what I'm saying is this was the vehicle as everybody was doing all these amendment after amendment. And remember, it was the Rukavina amendment to use these two resources, which were at that time called tax increases, if we would allow them to continue on. And I understood that that was how the governor felt as well. So now it's in this budget, and maybe you can clarify his position on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucheski, the straight answer on that is it was only recently in this recent budget preparation cycle that we were, the governor became aware of this 2001 legislation, which clearly anticipated that these revenues would move forward under a different nature. Mr. Chair, I think the page you're looking at has the language of the 2001 legislation that I thought was useful to include.
Well, Representative Rukavina, Representative Lucheski, we know that he's using gambling money this session to build those stadiums, so you don't need to worry about this money.
Mr. Chair,
Yeah, Representative Rick Covina.
Senator, I didn't catch it all, but didn't he say something about it? Just keep lying. People sometimes believe it. You know, Commissioner Salamone, I distinctly remember testimony, not testimony, the discussion that this was looked upon, that my amendment last year on this exact two uses of this money was looked upon as a tax increase.
Mr. Chair,
And it came from the governor's office, so the governor didn't know that this was sunsetting, is what you just said.
Yes. Mr. Chair,
yes.
I don't want to be misunderstood. I did not say we did not claim it was a tax increase last year.
No, but
we claimed it was a tax increase.
Chair, you said the governor didn't even know about these two items.
Mr. Chair, let me correct. If I did say that, let me correct that. What I said was that it was only recently that the governor became aware of the 2001 legislation that this would, that these taxes would be studied and then repackaged for continuation. That's the new piece of information he wasn't aware of back during the debate last session.
Mr. Chair, I'm really, I'm not the brightest bulb in the tree. What is repackaged?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rivina, the 2001 legislation asked the Revenue Department to take a look at these taxes to see what could be done with them to make them, through repackaging, if you will, to make them conform to the streamlined sales tax definitions. In fact, the next item we're going to talk about, recharacterizing our alcoholic beverage tax to make it be acceptable to the streamlined sales tax. That was the charge we were given in 2001.
Representative Rukavina, if you look at the on page 25,
about page 25.
On page 25, in the middle of the page, there's an actual statute that is reprinted here. It says the Commissioner of Revenue, in consultation with interested parties of the industry, shall prepare a plan to replace the current sales tax on short-term motor vehicle rentals. Okay. So that's what the commissioner is saying, is that I believe the commissioner is saying is that the governor became aware of this language recently or within the last,
correct,
I don't know how many months, saying that, and this is why he is now saying that this is not a, in his vernacular, a tax increase, but a continuation of an existing tax.
So, Mr. Chair, then on the next item where we see the recommendation on the extension, then if we call it that, of the alcohol excess alcohol tax, and so the governor recommends replacing the excess sales tax with a gross receipts tax, so that's really not a tax because we changed the name.
As they say in the land of television, tune in again next week because, members, we have session in 5 minutes. So I'm sure that everyone who is listening to this enthralling debate will be wanting to tune in again next week when we continue this presentation by the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, if I can just add, I noted the revenue involved here, but it's not a revenue increase. It's the same money moving forward. So.
Representative Knobloch, you'd be so kind as to move the minutes of Wednesday, January 26th.
So moved.
Any additions, corrections, deletions? Representative Cohen.
I noticed on the roll that my name is not listed in the white here yesterday.
We missed you. Make sure he's in there. Okay, we have that correction. All those in favor of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Minutes are approved, and we'll meet Tuesday. Meeting adjourned.